And welcome to Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. At least that's the title of my radio program. This is Kuma, and while I don't always talk about a railway legend, a myth, I do talk about stories, or I just simply talk about trains. So no one give me too much fuss about not holding to those other criteria. Anyhow, this time around, I wanted to talk about three things in a way. Trains with more than one locomotive, as well as locomotives distributed through the train, this is known as distributed power, and multiple units. I want to hit all three of these because they're sort of interrelated. All right. Now, why would you use more than one locomotive? Well, why would you use more than one horse to pull a wagon? Because it's a heavy wagon and you need two horses, or you maybe need four horses, or in the case of some, six or even eight horses. I do believe there were some stagecoaches that used eight. Four was a much more common number, but I do believe they had some longer sets. Heavy freight wagons would use many horses, or in some cases a couple of oxen, which were very strong but very slow. So anyway, there are reasons to have more than one locomotive, and the main reason is you need more pulling power. Now, we're going to start off by talking about steam engines. Oh yeah, steam engines. Well, in the early days of steam engines, a railroad might only own one locomotive. They were small operations. We're talking 1810, 1814. And if you did have two locomotives, it's because you needed two, because one was broken part of the time. I'm being honest. This is the truth how things worked. But it wasn't before too long that somebody figured out that it might be handy to use both locomotives, or maybe you had more than two, to pull a long string of cars all at once. Now, if you were running two steam locomotives, this is often called double heading. And double heading often looks very spectacular. Another one was triple heading, where you had three locomotives. But I want to make one thing very clear about the days of steam engines, and we're of course talking about the 19th century. In this case, every locomotive had a crew. In other words, this engine had a driver and somebody stoking the fire. In the next locomotive, there was a driver and someone stoking that fire. And there was, again, in the next locomotive. In the case of more than one locomotive, the driver, the engineer at the front of the train, was sort of running the show because they could see what they were doing. And it was an art form. I mean, I don't say it was science. It really was sort of a come-as-you-are, figure-it-out-as-you-go, some were better than others, and how to operate the two locomotives at the same time. Now, often they had simple whistle codes and things, and also it was simply a case of the lead locomotive would put on just a little bit of power, and you could literally hear it starting to pull up on the, even over the noise of the steam engine and everything else, you could feel it trying to pull. And that told the next driver to open their throttle. And it took a lot of, I say skill, but I'm almost going to say second guessing of at the highest order, to operate these multiple locomotives to move a large train. Now, one other thing that happens, and this happened all the way through on many railroads into the 20th century. Well, halfway through, maybe more. And what I'm talking about is another kind of distributed power, and that's a train that only needed help over just like a steep hill. And they're always having trouble with that. So they would have helper locomotives. In other words, these would be coupled on to the rear of the train. And by the way, in some cases, this was really tricky because the caboose had to be uncoupled, these locomotives coupled in, and the caboose coupled behind them because he didn't want to lose it. Because the caboose was made with a wooden frame and or light construction, and if you tried to push against it, against the rest of the train, you'd just crush it. Later in the 20th century, a number of railroads built their cabooses really strong. I mean, really stronger than most rail cars. Heavy steel frames, steel bodies, so they could be pushed directly. It saved a lot of operational time. So anyway, that's a pusher. That was a locomotive or even a pair of locomotives that would come up on the back of the train. In other words, you'd come up to a siding or a spot where they knew they were going to need the power because the hill is, you know, a ways down the track, whether it's 100 meters or 10 kilometers. You'd say, okay, this is the one spot where we can stop, have these pusher engines, a couple on, and they'd go, and they would help push the train up the hill. And they got to the top of the hill, they would quite often just run back down backwards, I mean quite literally, go back and go into their little siding and wait for the next train, because coming down the hill wasn't a problem, but it was going up the hill that was a problem. So that was the life of pusher engines. And matter of fact, in some railroads, pusher engines were massive engines. I mean, really, really big engines. They didn't need to go very fast. They didn't actually need to go very far. But they needed to have lots of pushing power. So sometime we'll come back and talk about some of those specialty steam engines. All right, now I'm going to come back to a little story here and tell you about something. This is again toward the end of the 19th century. And this is an example of distributed power, where you had, well, the helper was sort of distributed. It was at the end and you were at the front. This is one where they had a train with engines all through the train. All right, and let me see if I can get this straight. Now this was in 1897, and I believe it was the 6th of January, according to what I've read. Anyway, a very long train departed with a shipment that traveled via the Erie Railway and the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad. It went over a couple of different railroads. The funny part is I don't believe the train went all that far, but the particular routing route ran it over several different railroads. This wasn't uncommon in that part of the East. I mean, you could literally walk through three states and places, so it was even easier to get through three railroads. Anyhow, what it was the train was really long. How long? It had over 160 plus cars. I think 162 boxcars. What the heck? 162? I mean, even today that would be ridiculously long. Okay, let's get down here. This special train was so long as sort of a publicity stunt. A special train, it consisted of five engines. Now, one at the front, and really what this was, they took five trains and coupled them together. In truth, that's what they did. They took five trains and coupled them together and said, "Oh, look, we've got this super long train. Isn't that cool?" And the poor engineers and drivers of these five locomotives all had to figure out, what the heck is everybody doing? Tooting on their whistles, waiting for that slack and make it all go. But it did work. It sort of worked. It worked enough for the publicity stunt. And it was known as the Worcestershire Salt Special. Yeah. 162 boxcars of salt. Okay, why? As I said, a stunt. It was a stunt for publicity. Okay? That was the whole point. It was there just, you know, say, we had a super long train. All right. Now, I'm going to jump over here. I had notes. This isn't the first time, and I will get back to this in just a minute, because besides multiple units, locomotives, there's another thing called a multiple unit train. Now, what is a multiple unit train? Well, this is, and today, for the most part, I'm just saying for the most part, like 99%, are passenger trains. This is a passenger car that has motors in it, whether it's got diesel engine running motors directly or through electrical power, or an electrical multiple unit. A DMU is diesel multiple unit. EMU is electrical multiple unit. And electrical multiple units are one of the most popular way to run passenger trains everywhere in the world. It is one of the most popular by numbers, and I'll explain that in just a second. But the idea is if you have one car and it needs X amount of power to move it, well, to move two cars, you need 2X. But if each and every car has that much motive power, you can hook one car, two cars, three cars, four cars, five cars, six, eight, 10, and they all have enough horsepower and motive power to move them. Ah, here's the key bit. With multiple units, they are connected not just by a coupler, but by some sort of electrical hookup so that the controls in the lead unit operate the controls in every single unit following. This allows one driver to run a two-car unit, a three, four, five, whatever. Great. Believe me, that's a great thing, because you don't have to have, like we did in the days of 1897, having to have crews in every single one. So this allows a great deal of flexibility and, well, usefulness. Ah. But again, any idea can be taken just a little too far. So what happened was, in 2022, a Swiss company decided to go for a world record. Why? Because they wanted to go for a world record. So what they had were these four-car multiple unit trains. And they're sort of lashed together semi-permanently. You know, they're hooked together so that you have the cars are sort of semi-permanently coupled, but they can be coupled together. So these four units can be coupled to these four units, and now you got eight. Ah, they decided to couple together 25 of these. What? Yeah, 25 four-unit trains, making a total of a 100-car special train. The model was called the Capricorn, and we'll go into which company, but you can look this up if you really want to. But the interesting part, it was done on the Swiss meter gauge system. In Switzerland, there are tracks that are at the 1435 that used in Canada, the United States, Mexico, Great Britain, France, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Italy, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, which is actually Swiss track, but are operated by the Swiss, but let's not fuss with that. Anyway, but in Switzerland, there is, because of the mountains, narrow gauge is helpful. There is this extensive narrow gauge section, which is, in Switzerland, it's 1 meter. So, they hooked these all together. Now, these were electrical multiple units, and amazing that the overhead wire had enough power to run these. And it's even odder is the voltage, overhead voltage, was 11 kilovolts at 16.7 hertz, or 16.7 cycles per second. A very strange, well, to my ears, you know, I'm used to 60, 50 or DC, but 16.7? Anyhow, that's what they were using. It was AC, but it's a very slow AC. But here's one of the things. They had to actually run additional cables right down the center of the cars to make sure there was no lag in having the signal go through 100 cars that made up this train set. So it was run on this line in Switzerland. They only went about 25 kilometers, and the operators, of course, were biting their teeth because, you know, it could go really wrong. Anyway, that was done, as I said, as a publicity stunt. Boy, I can see if I can get that word right. And so they got into the Guinness Book of World Records, I believe, or that was listed as a record. And this was done in the Swiss Alps in the southeast part of Switzerland. Okay, that's great. So, again, it shows the versatility and usefulness of multiple units. Now, who else used multiple units? Guess what? Almost every major subway or underground railway in the world uses multiple units. Not all. I mean, there are mainline trains that, I mean, even diesel-pulled trains that go through tunnels. But I'm speaking of city tunnel networks or city rail systems. And they don't even have to be in tunnels. The S-Bahn of Munich, Germany, where I was, has the S-Bahn. It's made up entirely of multiple unit trains. And that's, just, as I said, each car has propulsion. There may only be one pantograph up, and the power is distributed through it, and all the little wheels turn, and off you go. So, that's multiple unit. And anybody asks me anytime, I can go on and on about multiple unit operation. It is used, I think one of the first places it was really used heavily in the United States was on the New York subway system in 1904. So, you know, looking at it today, we're talking about 122 years ago, you know. So this is not like a new thing. Anyhow, and by the way, I want to tell you, there's a really funny thing. Another trick that's not exactly multiple unit, and I'll come back to this some other time, which is called push-pull. And that's where you have a cab at one end of a passenger car, a passenger car, a couple of cars, and then a locomotive. And you can run it from the locomotive or you can run it from over here. And it does, it's not like multiple unit, except that it does have this cable running through the train to run the locomotive. And by the way, me and Publius saw one of these, a push-pull train set with a locomotive at one end and driving at the other. And it was a steam engine. And there was this unbelievable collection of air pipes and other, it was done not electrically but pneumatically to control the locomotive. Darndest thing. So, you know, the driver would be at one end and there'd be somebody working the fire at the other end. Oh my gosh, that's something. All right. Now I want to come back to something that's more common to North America, although this happens in multiple other countries, but my expertise, my most area, has been in North America. And I'm not pointing at just the United States. This is done in Canada. It's done in United States and the United States of Mexico and other places. I do believe it's not too uncommon in Australia, and I do believe it's in some places in Africa. And I'm sure there's a few run-ins somewhere in Europe. It's less likely because the trains don't tend to be so long. Now, remember I was telling you that you would put multiple locomotives. Well, one of the things that happened after the 1950s, now there were experiments before that, but that's not what I'm talking about. The major railways in North America switched to diesel-electric locomotives, okay? Diesel engine, which ran a generator, which made electricity, which ran traction motors. Okay, great. But they were, and there were multiple units. In other words, I know that the Santa Fe ran these beautiful A-B sets where the front had a cab and the B unit didn't have a cab. It just was a beautiful look. But they were wired together. I mean, there's a connectors and stuff, but they were kept wired together. So running that second locomotive right behind that locomotive, and maybe even two more behind that, was no problem. They were all cabled together, nice and wired up, just like the multiple units were. Well, the thing is, the railroads really wanted distributed power. Now, distributed power is like that silly salt train, where you have a locomotive at the front, or multiple locomotives to make enough horsepower, and then a locomotive further back in the train, you know, in the middle, or perhaps at the end, or perhaps all three. I've seen it. I've seen trains with just two locomotives at the front. I saw one today. A very heavy train, the engines were running flat out, and it was pulling a fairly heavy train. Just two locomotives in front. But I have seen daily a train set with three, four locomotives at the front, one or two locomotives in the middle, and another one or two locomotives at the end. Okay. That didn't really start until the late 1960s. And by doing that, they started to be able to operate those locomotives using radio control. I know that sounds like,
aren't they Wi-Fi equipped?
No, it's the fact that radio reliability wasn't good enough until about then, and they worked out all of the parameters of it, including if you lost signal, would the thing immediately stop running? When did it not stop running? You know, you go through a tunnel, you break radio contact for a few seconds, you want the train to suddenly go into emergency. There were a lot of considerations, and they started to run these. Matter of fact, I know one particular railroad had real trouble. Not with the equipment. No, I don't mean with the equipment. They had a problem because many railroaders were referring to the lead locomotive and the locomotive further back down the line as a slave locomotive. And they thought that had bad connotations. So they said, no, you can't call them that. You can call them remotes. You can call them distributed power. But no, that slave was a bad word. Now, I sort of see that. Anyway, this is distributed power. It is, and you might ask why. Well, first off, you want a really long train. Well, why not put more at the front? Well, the more horsepower you put at the front, the more likely you're going to break the train in two, because it's a very long train, and all of the weight of the train is on that coupler. And you're saying, what? Yeah. The longer the train, the more weight on that coupler right at the locomotive. I'm not joking. There's a lot of stress there. Now, if there's a locomotive halfway back and it starts to push a little bit, well, it's not going to bust the coupler up so much and you start to move. Well, that, you know, it distributes the power through the train. And in many cases, putting a locomotive all the way at the end of the train can reduce slack action. I'll talk about that again in a minute. But that's when the train goes crunk together or pops apart. I mean, it's literally a chain. It really is. It's like a chain. It's just the gaps are small, but there's lots of them. So to reduce the banging and pulling of this chain, you have a locomotive at the tail, and you slowly bunch the whole train up, and you all get it going. That's great. It reduces the amount of wear and tear on the train. It can reduce the wear and tear on cargo being carried on the train. That's a good thing for the railroad, because if they break stuff, they got to pay for it on their insurance and that. Remember, railroad executives do not want to spend money, and they don't want to lose money. So anything to reduce that. Now, remember, again, crew. You have the conductor and the driver, the engineer, and the front locomotive, and they're running 4, 5, 6. I've seen 8. I am not kidding. I've seen 8. I've seen 4 locomotives at the front, 2 locomotives in the middle, and 2 at the end. That's 8 locomotives total, 2 people operating it. And that train might be 100 cars. Not 160. No, they don't really run them that long. not very often anyway, but they can reach 100 cars. And with that distributed power, they operate fairly reliably and can go. And the other, here's an advantage. If you're running those extra power units, they're like having your own built-in helper train. You might not run the throttles up on those other locomotives in the train set. The ones in the middle and the ones at the tail might be running at very low power output. And then when you get to that hill, you go and run the engines wide up, and the train goes up the hill without slowing down as much as it would. And that keeps the train on schedule. Again, another handy thing. Now, after a period, I'll get into the dates because I want to talk about cabooses. Oh, everybody wants to see the little red caboose. Although some railroads wanted them yellow and some of them wanted it black for some odd reason. Anyhow, when they got rid of the caboose, they put a thing at the end of the train called an end-of-train device, sometimes called a FRED. It's a little radio control thing, and it lets you, well, it puts a blinking light at the back of the train, so there's a marker, and it allows you to open the air brake at the end. Well, if you have a locomotive at the end, of course, you don't need that device. The whole locomotive can not only provide power, it can also help braking. That's another thing. By having the locomotives all through the train, in the front, the middle, and the back, they have what's called air compressors, which, and we'll get into why you want air, but that was what makes the brakes work. And you having all these extra locomotives, it's a lot easier to keep the air in the line and make it reliable and happy to work. And again, an economical, reliable, safe to operate. Safe to operate's a good thing, even if the railroad executives sometimes forget this, because a safe train often doesn't cost as much. I mean, you might, taking too long. Well, the thing is, a wrecked train costs you a lot of money. So it's a real, real good idea not to have that happen. So that's what I've been talking about, is how you can have multiple power unit, multiple locomotives. Oh, and now I looked something up. I looked up something online and decided whoever wrote this either was from a different part of the country or the world. I don't know. They asked, what do you call multiple locomotives? And this person said, fleet. Well, I've never, been around railroaders often, I've never heard it called a fleet. Now, I've heard a fleet movement. That's where you have a whole bunch of trains all go east at one part of the day, and then and so that you don't have to have, you know, other trains coming the other way, and it's sort of like one-way traffic. No, when they hook a bunch of locomotives together, most railroaders I know have called them a lash or a lash-up. So it's a two-unit lash-up, a three, a four-unit lash-up. So there's your little railroad word, lash. No, it's just, you know, like tying together. That's lashing something. So anyway, I've got, I think, about a minute or two left to go. That'll give me some time to put a little music at the front and the back. And I hope it entertains you a little bit about how trains work. And again, we'll try to get to other subjects and tell people about stuff. Anyhow, that's all for now, and we'll see you on the train. Bye-bye.